This is Canadian environmentalist and broadcaster David Suzuki speaking at a feature called Wild Things with Wings in Toronto on May 3rd, 2008. It was recorded by J.P. Warren. Thank you, J.P. And here it is, introduced by Bob MacDonald, the famous host of Canadian Broadcasting Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Wild Things with Wings. I'm Bob MacDonald. How are you today? Wow. Welcome to the beautifully renovated Music Hall Theater. Gee, the last time I was in here, it was red. The ceiling was falling in. And half of the seats in the center, when you sat in them, you actually fell on the floor because they went down too far. So it's really beautiful to be. I think, I'm not sure, but I think this is one of the original vaudeville theaters in Toronto. There were about six or eight of them. The Fox, the Roxy, the Winter Garden, and this one, I think, were all vaudeville theaters. So it's really neat to be in this historic place. We're here today to celebrate the little creatures that do work for us. And we have three very interesting speakers and one performer. We have Lawrence Packer, who probably has more bees than anyone. And we're going to have Marjorie Harris, the garden lady. You may be familiar with her on the radio. And we're going to hear from the other science guy at CBC. I've heard he's good. Now, this event marks the launch of a campaign by the David Suzuki Foundation, and it's to raise awareness of the urban pollinators and the ecosystem services that they provide. It's also co-hosted by Evergreen, Seeds of Diversity Canada, and Food Share, and there's information on each of these in the lobby. It's kind of odd for me to introduce David Suzuki. David and I actually don't like to be in the same room at the same time, because if the ceiling falls in, there goes half the science journalism in Canada. So we're really nervous being in the same room at the same time. David was the original host of Quirks and Quarks, the show that I now host, and I'm privileged to do that. And our show is now in the 34th year. It's astounding. And David was the first host. You also know him from the Nature of Things, and of course he's the founder of the David Suzuki Foundation. He's an award-winning scientist, he's an environmentalist, broadcaster, and he's received consistently high acclaim for 30 years of award-winning work in his broadcasting, explaining the complexities of science, and of course he's known around the world. He's a household name. Please welcome David Suzuki.
Thank you. Thank you. Gosh, listening to the first two speakers, I had all kinds of ideas coming into my head about what I could talk to you about, anecdotes. I do want to say to Marjorie, you know, when you talk about using all the leaves possible, when the war ended, the Second World War ended, we were moved out to Ontario. And, of course, we were impoverished by what happened during the war. So we had to grow a great deal of our food in the garden that we had. And Dad would go every fall and gather the leaves that had fallen onto the road. He loved the piles of leaves that had been squashed by the cars. He said, that's the best compost you could have. Now, you got to remember, in the late 1940s, I was just going through puberty, and our first car was a Model A Ford. My dad had made a little box that we put onto the bumper of the Model A Ford, and every night after dinner, I'd have to go out with my dad and shovel these crushed leaves into this box to take back, and then my job was to dig them into the garden. Well, you can imagine a 14-year-old kid praying that nobody would see him in a Model A Ford taking leaves and having to take... It was a terrible... I mean, I've been scarred for life by that. That's just the story about composting. Anyway, we moved to Leamington after the end of the war. That was the first place we moved to. And every spring was this amazing outpouring of nature, which was a hatch of mayflies off Lake Erie. They would hatch in such numbers that they would actually coat the highways with their carcasses, bodies, and cars would skid and get into accidents on them. They could cover entire houses, and they would pile up on the beaches, their carcasses 3 feet deep. It was an amazing example of biomass, the productivity of nature. And within 10 years, that enormous outpouring of biomass was gone because of the increased use of pesticides in farmers' fields. That was, but for me, as a boy, that was just a wonderful example of nature right there in the lake. And insects then became this great passion of my life. Unlike Dr. Packard, I was fascinated by beetles. I absolutely adored beetles. And I was thrilled to hear his discussion, far too short, about the world of bees. Because, you know, we tend to demonize creepy crawlies. Don't bring that in here. You know, it might sting you. And there's just a wonderful world for any child that awaits us in the world of insects, many of which are pollinators. So, and one of the things I have to say is that people like Dr. Packard are increasingly rare in the biological world, because we tend to get caught up in funding sexy areas like DNA and nanotechnology, and we don't support the kind of scientists that are telling us about the wonderful diversity on this planet. Anyway, those are things that just came up during the talks that were presented. When I read in the newspapers about the mysterious disappearance of honeybees, I have to admit that a bolt of fear ran through me. A bolt of fear, because here was one of the many, many pollinators, but a significant pollinator for us, that is a part of what keeps the world together. And their loss, the loss of a component of this biodiverse world, means that we tear at the thread of living things that could ultimately signal major changes or collapses of biodiversity. I told this afternoon earlier, I told the story that E.O. Wilson tells us, one of the great naturalists at Harvard University. His area is of specialty is ants. And to put things in perspective, he said, you know, if all human beings in the world disappeared overnight, we suddenly became an extinct species, probably less than a dozen other species would also go extinct. Those would be things that live in our armpits and our guts that depend on us for their survival. But the rest of nature would rebound, and we'd be greening the planet, and animals would increase in abundance. But he says that if all of the ants in the world disappeared, terrestrial ecosystems around the world would completely collapse. And it kind of puts us into perspective about how important we are. What I want to do tonight is to provide some context within which to think about the things that Marjorie and Dr. Packard have been talking about. For most of human existence, we were another animal species that lived in as nomadic hunter-gatherers. That was what the way we lived was like for 99% of human existence. Nature, for most of our existence, was vast. And we lived within this vast network of living organisms. We lived with an attitude or an outlook that we call biocentric. We saw ourselves not at the top of the heap. We saw ourselves as a part of a wonderfully diverse net of living things. We understood in a biocentric world that we were interlinked, interconnected, and interdependent on the rest of the living world for our survival and well-being. And in a world of interconnections, everything that we do has repercussions, because everything is linked to everything else. And therefore, everything we do has responsibilities. In the world for most of human existence, that the repercussions of the way we lived could be seen. If there was a birth of a severely handicapped child, perhaps even a two-headed baby, or if we were out in nature and we spot an albino deer, people didn't just write it off as a fluke, some kind of one-in-a-million event. they sat there going, holy cow, what are the implications of that? What does it mean? Because everything was interconnected, and those extraordinary events might be a portent of something incredible to happen in the future, or we might be being punished for something that we did in the past. So these, we lived in a world of complete interconnectivity. In such a world, then we had to exist with humility. We had to exist with a sense of reverence for what we received and a sense of gratitude for nature's abundance. We've undergone an enormous transformation in the way we see the world in the 20th century. When I was born in 1936, a world very different from today. When I was born, there was no television anywhere on the planet. When I tell children this today, they look at me, they can't believe anybody can be that old. But the immediate question is, what did you do? Like to a child today, a world without television is inconceivable. An ancient civilization, long extinct. And it's unimaginable that you could have fun without television. When I was a child, my mom and dad wouldn't let me go to public swimming pools or to movies in the summer because they were afraid I would catch polio. Most children today have no idea what polio is. When I was a boy, there was smallpox killed hundreds of thousands of people a year and horribly scarred many times that number. Smallpox has been extinct for over 30 years. When I was a child, there were no computers. There were no transoceanic phone calls. There were no Xerox or CDs, and I could go on literally listing dozens and dozens of things that have become a part of our lives. And technology has changed our lives enormously in the 20th century and given us this illusion of power and control. But we've also bought into this technological industrial model, which is a linear way of looking. We think of time as being linear, going from the past into the future, and we think of the way that we live in a linear way. We extract resources out of the earth. We process them, manufacture things, use those things, and when we're done with them, we throw them back into the earth. In nature isn't linear in this fashion. When an elephant poops on the plains, immediately insects and fungi jump on it and go, yummy, lunch. Because in nature, it's cycle upon cycle. There is not this linear way of looking at the world. In 1900, most people in the world lived in rural village communities. There were only 1.5 billion people living on the planet, and only 16 cities with more than 1 million people. London was the largest with 6.5 million, and Tokyo was the 7th largest with 1.5 million people. Over 90% of the world, including in Canada, lived in rural village communities. We were farmers. Most people in the world were involved in farming activity. And when you're a farmer, you understand the importance of the seasons. You understand that the winter snow is related to how much water or moisture you've got in the summer. And you know about insect pests and good insects and good plants and weed plants. And one understands the importance of the natural world. In only 100 years, we underwent a massive transformation. Of course, the number of people had changed enormously, 4 times as many, from 1.5 billion to 6 by the year 2000. But there were now more than 400 cities with more than 1 million people. The 10 largest cities all had more than 11 million people. Tokyo was the largest city in the year 2000 with 26 million people. Can you imagine? 26 million people living in one city. But it meant, especially in the industrialized world, the vast majority of people now lived in big cities. And in a big city, the economy becomes our highest priority. And we think that we're so clever that we now create our own habitat, and we really don't need nature. If we want nature for entertainment, we'll go to a park and enjoy it. But we see ourselves as somehow separate from the natural world. We're isolated. And we now have come to see the world in a fragmented way. a world in which is anthropocentric. That is, we see ourselves as being at the top of the heap. And basically everything else is potentially under our control and for our use. The global economy that we live in now sees the entire planet as a source of raw materials. We just have to find a use for them, and we'll exploit them as we wish. We live in a shattered world. And in a shattered world, there we now are unaware of causal connection. And I think this is one of the big problems that we face. It means that we don't see a connection between what we do and what happens out there in the rest of the planet. And you just have to read something like the Globe and Mail. Read the Globe and Mail on any day. You may see a story about forest fires in Alberta, floods in Bangladesh, a drought in Ethiopia, and melting icebergs in the Arctic. And they're all reported as if they've got nothing to do with each other. So yet the underlying commonality very well could be that climate is affecting these things. I must admit I'm an avid listener to the 6 o'clock evening news on CBC, but when you think about a half hour newscast, there may be up to 20 items or reports in a half hour. The average length of time of these items may be from 15 to 90 seconds. And again, they're disparate things that have no connection with each other. When the announcer comes on and says, "And tonight we bring you an in-depth report," he's talking about a two-minute report. I mean, how can you have any kind of depth to a report like that? Context to tell you why this thing happened, why is this a bit of news, and what can we do about it? None of that is in there. So that the world is shattered by the way that we acquire our news. And in a disconnected world, or shattered world, as I say, we don't see causal relationships. When I first saw a child having a full-blown asthma attack, I was absolutely horrified, and realizing that 15% of Canadian children are now born with asthma, and that rate is skyrocketing. And I said to my boss at CBC, we've got to do a show on asthma for the nature of things. So I said, let's wait for a smog alert day in Toronto, and we'll send a crew down to the emergency ward. And, of course, in Toronto, in the summer, you don't have to wait more than a day or two to have a smog alert. And I was shocked when I went there to see they were just jammed with elders and children coming in, being brought in by people terrified they wouldn't get their child or their parents in to see a doctor in time. But the shocking thing to me was I knew the people bringing their loved ones into the hospital would have done anything to avoid these terrifying episodes. But many of them drove up in a sports utility vehicle. And so you realize that we just don't see the connections any longer between the things that we do, the way we live, and the consequences for the rest of the planet. We feel that we work to earn a living, to earn an income, and then once we have that money, we then buy it spend it for whatever we want. We buy food, you know, here in Canada. The first thing I do when I get up in the morning is grind a few coffee beans, but I don't very often think, gee whiz, Canada's a cold country. Where the hell are these coffee beans from? You know, they sure as heck weren't grown in Canada. Or we don't ask more profound questions like, where were they raised? Were they grown in the shade? Were there chemicals used on them? How much did the people that harvested them get paid? We don't think any things. We just need our coffee hit, and we buy it, grind it, and use it, and don't think much about it. It's the same. My daughter, who's a very rabid environmentalist, is on a tirade about chocolate, that the vast bulk of chocolate that we just take for granted is there's a great deal of slavery. Children are used to grow chocolate, to exploit chocolate, and that we've got to think, she says, we've got to think much more seriously about something we take for granted as a pleasure in our lives. And I'm on a tirade, I must admit, about salmon. I mean, everybody wants their omega-3 and salmon, you know, well, we love salmon. And here in Toronto, I ask people, well, what kind of salmon is that? And they go, well, what are you talking about? It's salmon, I just bought it. Well, is it Atlantic or is it Pacific? If it's Atlantic salmon, that's a farmed salmon. And they go, well, who cares? What difference does it make? Well, it makes a huge bit of difference. First of all, if it's farmed, you know that you've biomagnified chemicals in the feed that you gave it, and I wouldn't eat it because it's full of toxic stuff. But not only that, it's an ecological and a social disaster. But I won't go on and give you that tirade today. But, but people don't understand. You know, it's food. They want their omega-3, and that's as far as it goes. There are 5 species of Pacific salmon. You got to say, if it's Atlantic, don't eat it. And here in Ontario, I would suggest that probably 99% of the salmon that you buy is Atlantic. So it's farmed. If it's Pacific salmon, you got to say, well, gee, there are 5 species. Is it sockeye, chum, or pink? If it is, eat it. They're not farmed. But if it's coho or chum or chinook, those are farmed. So you got to find out whether they're farmed. Is it from Alaska? Because none of their salmon are farmed. The repercussions of what we do are immense. Well, I might just say one of the major repercussions is salmon are carnivores. What land animal do we grow for food that's a carnivore? I mean, that's like saying I want to eat tigers and lions, so we're going to grow tigers and lions and feed them chickens, pigs, and goats. I mean, that's kind of a dumb thing to do, and we don't do it. But for fish, we don't think anything of the fact that salmon have to eat fish. Well, you could try to convert them into herbivores, but the Japanese tell us when more than 16% of the pellets come from vegetables, they taste awful. So you can't convert a carnivore into a herbivore and think that you're going to have something edible. That feed that we use for the salmon is fish. And most of it comes from the Pacific and South America, food fish for native people that are now being deprived of through the loss of these fish that are going to feed salmon. So the repercussions of eating a salmon are enormous, and we don't think about it. Same thing with clothing. You know, you go to buy an article of clothing, you want a cotton shirt. Cotton is one of the most chemically intensive crops that we grow. Do we ever ask, where did you get, is it organic cotton? Where was the cotton grown? What about the effect on the people around there? We just want a cotton shirt, preferably with some logo that you want, and that's it. And I could go on and on. You know, you buy a television, a car, or a computer, and we want the right brand so that it's reliable, but gee, they're filled with all kinds of minerals, of metals. Mining is one of our most destructive activities. Where were the metals mined? What about the effect on the ecosystems in the area, on the people that had to do the mining? And what happens when we're done with them and throw them away? We live in a world that we accept that, you know, I went to buy the other day one of those power things you plug into your computer to store your, what do they call those, sticks, right? There was so much plastic packaging on this stick that was about this big, you know, came to that much, and it's almost impervious, you can't get, and then when you take the stick out, all that stuff's supposed to go in to the landfill. We accept a degree of packaging that is absolutely outrageous. And then we accept that we can buy disposable products. Disposability is something that doesn't make any sense when there are products that are durable and you don't need to be disposable. I believe that disposable ought to be a word every bit as unacceptable as saying shit in public. It's not a word that you want your children to accept. The problem is that we live within this global economy in which those connections are now hidden. It becomes very, very difficult to track the history of whatever we're purchasing, to see where it comes from and what the impact is. So I believe that the challenge of the 21st century is to put the world back together again, to see where we fit in this exquisitely interconnected world, to recognize that this, what you might think is a tiny component, the pollinators, are a part of what keep the world together. The bolt of fear that went through my body when I heard about the honeybees was the fear that if the pollinators of the world all disappeared, what will we do about the flowering plants? Ecosystems on land will collapse, and you can sure as hell bet that we will go extinct. It's as simple as, would you agree with me, Dr. Packard, that We could not survive a world without flowering plants, and we are the top predator on the planet. We've got to put the world back together again. We've got to see that we're not in control, that we live in an interlinked, interconnected, and interdependent community of organisms, and that everything that we do has consequences. And that's the... That's the change that has to take place. But you begin then, as one shifts, to think in a biocentric way and to recover the aspects of humility. Humility, and I loved hearing the speakers today just say, I don't know. We don't know anything about these. We don't know anything about bees. We don't know anything about plants. Our ignorance is vast. And humility is one of the great attributes that we need today. And we have. I think that what we have to do is, instead of thinking we're so clever, we can pound nature into submission, as we've tried to do with things like pesticides, one of the dumbest things I can ever imagine in the 20th century. You know, insects are the most important group of animals on the planet. It's estimated for every human being on Earth today, there are at least 200 million insects. So long after we go extinct, believe me, there'll be plenty of insects around. And insects are very, very important components of ecosystems around the world. And we don't know anything about the complexity of those. Geez, I've forgotten what I was saying. There you go, Marjorie. I'm having an elderly fit right now, and I don't know where I was driving at, but insects are important parts of ecosystems, and we've got to learn to value them and learn how they operate and learn from them. We think that we're so clever, our technology, yes, we can invent very powerful technologies, that we can pound nature into submission. And we try to do that with pesticides. Wait a minute now. Maybe one out of every 1,000 species of insects is a pest to human beings. The vast majority of insects are very important components of ecosystems. Got nothing to do with the way that we live or grow our food. Why would you use pesticides that kill all insects just to get at the one or two that are pests to human beings? I mean, that, don't tell me that's management. That would be like saying, hey, we got a problem with crime in Toronto. Let's kill everybody in the city. That's one way to get rid of crime. But it's the dumbest way to manage crime, if you ask me. So, I think the change that's happening now is the recognition that nature has had 4 billion years of evolution. Nature from the beginning had to deal with the same problems as human beings we deal with. Where do you get your food? How do you avoid getting sick? What do you do about predators? What do you do with your wastes? How do you find shelter and security? Organisms since the beginning of time for 4 billion years have been dealing with those same problems. Maybe if we were a bit more humble and we look to nature, we might ask, how the hell do you do it? Maybe if we studied more bees, we might gain some very profound insights into how they've evolved ways of dealing with problems we are trying to deal with. And then we could try to copy them. This has been called by Janine Benyus, biomimicry. Biomimicry is a radically different way of looking at the world and how we interact with it. It means coming with humility and understanding a huge amount of evolutionary wisdom built into nature, and that we can learn a great deal and how we can live on this planet. Thank you very much.